This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Thomas Sowell Reader by Thomas Sowell. This book is read by Robertson Dean. Preface. Summarizing the work of a lifetime can be a challenge, even for someone who is stuck to one specialty. I found it even more challenging because of my very long lifetime and the wide-ranging fields in which I have written over the years, ranging from economic writings and academic journals to both humorous and serious newspaper columns on everything from baseball to politics to war to late-talking children, not to mention a few books on history, housing, autobiography, intellectuals, and race. Frankly, it would never have occurred to me to try to collect all these very different things within the covers of one book, had the idea not been suggested to me by John Scherer, publisher of Basic Books. I am glad he did, however. A sampling of all these items may have more things to interest the general reader than a book devoted to one subject, aimed at one audience. In each of the various sections of the book, whether on culture, economics, politics, law, education, or race, I have led off with newspaper columns before moving on to longer writings that permit more in-depth explorations. Each reader can choose from a wide spectrum of subjects to explore and decide which to sample and which to go into more deeply. Some of the most popular of my newspaper columns have been those titled Random Thoughts. Various unrelated statements about the passing scene from some of these columns have been collected in the Random Thoughts section of this book. My hope is that this large selection of my writings will reduce the likelihood that readers will misunderstand what I have said on many controversial issues over the years. Whether the reader will agree with all my conclusions is another question entirely, but disagreements can be productive, while misunderstandings seldom are. One reason for some misunderstandings is that my approach and my goals have been too plain and straightforward for those people who are looking for hidden agendas or other complex motives. From an early age, I have been concerned with trying to understand the social problems that abound in any society. First and foremost, this was an attempt to try to grasp some explanation of the puzzling and disturbing things going on around me. This was all for my own personal clarification, since I had neither political ambitions nor the political talents required for either elective or appointed office. But, once having achieved some sense of understanding of particular issues, a process that sometimes took years, I wanted to share that understanding with others. That is the reason for the things that appear in this book. Thomas Sowell, The Hoover Institution, Stanford University. Social Issues. Grasshopper and Ant. Just as the Rocky and Star Wars movies had their sequels, so should the old classic fables. Here is the sequel to a well-known fable. Once upon a time, a grasshopper and an ant lived in a field. All summer long, the grasshopper romped and played, while the ant worked hard under the boiling sun to store up food for the winter. When winter came, the grasshopper was hungry. One cold and rainy day, he went to ask the ant for some food. "What, are you crazy?" the ant said. "I've been breaking my back all summer long while you ran around hopping and laughing at me for missing all the fun in life."
"Did I do that?" the grasshopper asked meekly.
"Yes. You said I was one of those old-fashioned clods who had missed the whole point of the modern self-realization philosophy."
"Gee, I'm sorry about that," the grasshopper said. "I didn't realize you were so sensitive. But surely you were not going to hold that against me at a time like this."
"Well, I don't hold a grudge, but I do have a long memory." Just then another ant came along.
"Hi, Lefty," the first ant said.
"Hi, George."
"Lefty, do you know what this grasshopper wants me to do? He wants me to give him some of the food I worked for all summer under the blazing sun."
"I would have thought you would already have volunteered to share with him without being asked," Lefty said.
"What?"
"When we have disparate shares in the bounty of nature, the least we can do is try to correct the inequity."
"Nature's bounty my foot," George said. "I had to tote this stuff uphill and cross a stream on a log, all the while looking out for anteaters. Why couldn't this lazy bum gather his own food and store it?"
"Now, now, George," Lefty soothed. "Nobody uses the word bum anymore. We say the homeless."
"I say bum. Anyone who is too lazy to put a roof over his head, who prefers to stand out in this cold rain to doing a little work,"
the grasshopper broke in.
"I didn't know it was going to rain like this. The weather forecast said fair and warmer."
"Fair and warmer?" George sniffed. "That's what the forecasters told Noah."
Lefty looked pained.
"I'm surprised at your callousness, George, your selfishness, your greed."
"Have you gone crazy, Lefty?"
"No, on the contrary, I have become educated."
"Sometimes that's worse these days."
"Last summer, I followed a trail of cookie crumbs left by some students. It led to a classroom at Ivy University."
"You've been to college? No wonder you come back here with all these big words and dumb ideas."
"I disdain to answer that," Lefty said. "Anyway, it was Professor Murky's course on social justice. He explained how the world's benefits are unequally distributed."
"The world's benefits?" George repeated. "The world didn't carry this food uphill. The world didn't cross the water on a log. The world isn't going to be eaten by any anteater."
"That's the narrow way of looking at it," Lefty said.
"If you're so generous, why don't you feed this grasshopper?"
"I will," Lefty replied. Then, turning to the grasshopper, he said, "Follow me. I will take you to the government's shelter, where there will be food and a dry place to sleep."
George gasped.
"You're working for the government now?"
"I'm in public service," Lefty said loftily. "I want to make a difference in this world."
"You really have been to college," George said. "But if you're such a friend of the grasshopper, why don't you teach him how to work during the summer and save something for the winter?"
"We have no right to change his lifestyle and try to make him like us. That would be cultural imperialism."
George was too stunned to answer. Lefty not only won the argument, he continued to expand his program of shelters for grasshoppers. As word spread, grasshoppers came from miles around. Eventually, some of the younger ants decided to adopt the grasshopper lifestyle. As the older generation of ants passed from the scene, more and more ants joined the grasshoppers, romping and playing in the fields. Finally, all the ants and all the grasshoppers spent all their time enjoying the carefree lifestyle and lived happily ever after, all summer long. Then the winter came. Ever wonder why? When you have seen scenes of poverty and squalor in many third world countries, either in person or in pictures, have you ever wondered why we in America have been spared such a fate? When you have learned of the bitter oppressions that so many people have suffered under in despotic countries around the world, have you ever wondered why Americans have been spared? Have scenes of government-sponsored carnage and lethal mob violence in countries like Rwanda or in the Balkans ever made you wonder why such horrifying scenes are not found on the streets of America? Nothing is easier than to take for granted what we are used to, and to imagine that it is more or less natural, so that it requires no explanation. Instead, many Americans demand explanations of why things are not even better, and express indignation that they are not. Some people think the issue is whether the glass is half empty or half full. More fundamentally, the question is whether the glass started out empty or started out full. Those who are constantly looking for the root causes of poverty, of crime, and of other national and international problems act as if prosperity and law-abiding behavior are so natural that it is their absence which has to be explained. But a casual glance around the world today, or back through history, would dispel any notion that good things just happen naturally, much less inevitably. The United States of America is the exception, not the rule. Once we realize that America is an exception, we might even have a sense of gratitude for having been born here, even if gratitude has become uncool in many quarters. At the very least, we might develop some concern for seeing that whatever has made this country better off is not lost or discarded, or eroded away bit by bit until it is gone. Those among us who are constantly rhapsodizing about change in vague and general terms seem to have no fear that a blank check for change can be a huge risk in a world where so many other countries that are different are also far worse off. Chirping about change may produce a giddy sense of excitement or of personal exultation, but, as usual, the devil is in the details. Even despotic countries that have embraced sweeping changes have often found that these were changes for the worse. The czars in Russia, the Shah of Iran, the Batista regime in Cuba were all despotic, but they looked like sweethearts compared to the regimes that followed. For example, the czars never executed as many people in half a century as Stalin did in one day. Even the best countries must make changes, and the United States has made many economic, social, and political changes for the better. But that is wholly different from making change a mantra. To be for or against change in general is childish. Everything depends on the specifics. To be for generic change is to say that what we have is so bad that any change is likely to be for the better. Such a pose may make some people feel superior to others who find much that is worth preserving in our values, traditions, and institutions. The status quo is never sacrosanct, but its very existence proves that it is viable, as seductive theoretical alternatives may not turn out to be. Most Americans take our values, traditions, and institutions so much for granted that they find it hard to realize how much all these things are under constant attack in our schools, our colleges, and in much of the press, the movies, and literature. There is a culture war going on within the United States, and in fact, within Western civilization as a whole, which may ultimately have as much to do with our survival, or failure to survive, as the war on terrorism. There are all sorts of financial, ideological, and psychic rewards for undermining American society and its values. Unless some of us realize the existence of this culture war and the high stakes in it, we can lose what cost those Americans before us so much to win and preserve. A duty to die? One of the many fashionable notions that have caught on among some of the intelligentsia is that old people have a duty to die rather than become a burden to others. This is more than just an idea discussed around a seminar table. Already, the government-run medical system in Britain is restricting what medications or treatments it will authorize for the elderly. Moreover, it seems almost certain that similar attempts to contain runaway costs will lead to similar policies when American medical care is taken over by the government. Make no mistake about it, letting old people die is a lot cheaper than spending the kind of money required to keep them alive and well. If a government-run medical system is going to save any serious amount of money, it is almost certain to do so by sacrificing the elderly. There was a time, fortunately now long past, when some desperately poor societies had to abandon old people to their fate, because there was just not enough margin for everyone to survive. Sometimes the elderly themselves would simply go off from their family and community to face their fate alone. But is that where we are today? Talk about a duty to die made me think back to my early childhood in the South during the Great Depression of the 1930s. One day, I was told that an older lady, a relative of ours, was going to come and stay with us for a while, and I was told how to be polite and considerate towards her. She was called Aunt Nance Ann, but I don't know what her official name was or what her actual biological relationship to us was. Aunt Nance Ann had no home of her own, but she moved around from relative to relative, not spending enough time in any one home to be a real burden. At that time, we didn't have things like electricity or central heating or hot running water, but we had a roof over our heads and food on the table, and Aunt Nance Anne was welcome to both. Poor as we were, I never heard anybody say, or even intimate, that Aunt Nance Anne had a duty to die. I only began to hear that kind of talk decades later, from highly educated people in an affluent age, when even most families living below the official poverty level owned a car or truck and had air conditioning. It is today, in an age when homes have flat-paneled TVs and most families eat in restaurants regularly or have pizzas and other meals delivered to their homes, that the elites, rather than the masses, have begun talking about a duty to die. Back in the days of Aunt Nance Anne, nobody in our family had ever gone to college. Indeed, none had gone beyond elementary school. Apparently, you need a lot of expensive education, sometimes including courses on ethics, before you can start talking about a duty to die. Many years later, while going through a divorce, I told a friend that I was considering contesting child custody. She immediately urged me not to do it. Why? Because raising a child would interfere with my career. But my son didn't have a career. He was just a child who needed someone who understood him. I ended up with custody of my son, and, although he was not a demanding child, raising him could not help impeding my career a little. But do you just abandon a child when it is inconvenient to raise him? The lady who gave me this advice had a degree from the Harvard Law School. She had more years of education than my whole family had back in the days of Aunt Nance Anne. Much of what is taught in our schools and colleges today seeks to break down traditional values and replace them with more fancy and fashionable notions, of which a duty to die is just one. These efforts at changing values used to be called values clarification, though the name has had to be changed repeatedly over the years as more and more parents caught on to what was going on and objected. The values that supposedly needed clarification had been clear enough to last for generations, and nobody asked the schools and colleges for this clarification. Nor are we better people because of it. The Money of Fools. 17th-century philosopher Thomas Hobbes said that words are wise men's counters, but they are the money of fools. That is as painfully true today as it was 4 centuries ago. Using words as vehicles to try to convey your meaning is very different from taking words so literally that the words use you and confuse you. Take the simple phrase, rent control. If you take these words literally, as if they were money in the bank, you get a complete distortion of reality. New York is the city with the oldest and strongest rent control laws in the nation. San Francisco is second. But if you look at cities with the highest average rents, New York is first and San Francisco is second. Obviously, rent control laws do not control rent. If you check out the facts instead of relying on words, you will discover that gun control laws do not control guns, the government's stimulus spending does not stimulate the economy, and that many compassionate policies inflict cruel results, such as the destruction of the black family. Do you know how many millions of people died in the war to make the world safe for democracy, a war that led to autocratic dynasties being replaced by totalitarian dictatorships that slaughtered far more of their own people than the dynasties had? Warm, fuzzy words and phrases have an enormous advantage in politics. None has had such a long run of political success as social justice. The idea cannot be refuted, because it has no specific meaning. Fighting it would be like trying to punch the fog. No wonder social justice has been such a political success for more than a century, and counting. While the term has no defined meaning, it has emotionally powerful connotations. There is a strong sense that it is simply not right, that it is unjust, that some people are so much better off than others. Justification, even as the term is used in printing and carpentry, means aligning one thing with another. But what is the standard to which we think incomes or other benefits should be aligned? Is the person who has spent years in school goofing off, acting up, or fighting, squandering the tens of thousands of dollars that the taxpayers have spent on his education, supposed to end up with his income aligned with that of the person who spent those same years studying to acquire knowledge and skills that would later be valuable to himself and to society at large? Some advocates of social justice would argue that what is fundamentally unjust is that one person is born into circumstances that make that person's chances in life radically different from the chances that others have, through no fault of one and through no merit of the others. Maybe the person who wasted educational opportunities and developed self-destructive behavior would have turned out differently if born into a different home or a different community. That would, of course, be more just. But now we are no longer talking about social justice, unless we believe that it is all society's fault that different families and communities have different values and priorities, and that society can solve that problem. Nor can poverty or poor education explain such differences. There are individuals who were raised by parents who were both poor and poorly educated, but who pushed their children to get the education that the parents themselves never had. Many individuals and groups would not be where they are today without that. All kinds of chance encounters, with particular people, information, or circumstances, have marked turning points in many individuals' lives, whether toward fulfillment or ruin. None of these things is equal or can be made equal. If this is an injustice, it is not a social injustice, because it is beyond the power of society. You can talk or act as if society is both omniscient and omnipotent, but to do so would be to let words become what Thomas Hobbes called them, the money of fools. Boomers and Boomerangs. Time was when grandparents often moved in with their children and grandchildren, especially when the grandparent was a widow or widower, or just had trouble making ends meet financially. Today, it is the children and grandchildren who move in with the grandparents. A recent Census Bureau report shows that there are three times as many households where the children and grandchildren are living in the grandparents' home as there are where the grandparents are living with their children and grandchildren. Moreover, this trend is growing. Back in 1970, there were a little more than 2 million children under 18 who were living in their grandparents' households. By 1997, that had reached nearly 4 million. 6% of all children under 18 live in their grandparents' households. There was a time when any adult who had gone out into the world would be embarrassed to come back and live with his parents, much less bring his or her family too. Today, this is such a common occurrence among the baby boomers that there is a word for grown children who leave home and then come back: boomerangs. Perhaps the worst situation of all is when both parents have skipped out and dumped their children on grandma and grandpa. This happens about one-third of the time when grandchildren are living in their grandparents' home. These grandparents are not rich people living on investments and annuities. Most of the grandparents are working, even if their children aren't. Moreover, they suffer more depression and other health problems than grandparents without such burdens. Bad as this is, what is worse is to contemplate what is going to happen when the last of the responsible generation, those who feel the responsibility to look out for both their aging parents and their adult children, pass from the scene, leaving behind only the me generation. This is only one of many social time bombs ticking away while we enjoy a prospering economy. We may hope that the me generation will grow up when they run out of other people to dump their responsibilities on, but don't bet the rent money on it. People don't usually grow up when there are other people who make excuses for their immaturity. In a non-judgmental world, who is to tell irresponsible parents to grow up? Even when the parents are present and have their children in their own homes, they seem increasingly to be letting these children pretty much raise themselves. When a woman was complaining recently about some bratty and even dangerous behavior she sees in children, I asked, "Where are their parents?" She replied, "There are no parents today." I had to admit that she had a point. One of the biggest excuses for lax parenting is that both parents have to work in order to make ends meet. Yet, within living memory, it was common in working-class families, black and white, for the husband to work and the wife to stay home to raise the children. Why didn't both parents have to work then in order to make ends meet? Were people so much richer then? On the contrary, they were much poorer. Today's families living in poverty have things that average Americans could not afford then. People today eat in restaurants more times in a month than they used to in a year, or in some cases a decade. As a young man, I was uneasy when I began eating in restaurants because I had so seldom eaten in one while growing up. As for having a car, the thought never crossed my mind. If people in those days had lived the way we live today, of course it would have taken both parents to make ends meet. They would probably have had to put the children to work, too. People make choices and have their own priorities, and adults take responsibilities for their choices and priorities. It is a cop-out to say that they are forced to have two-income families just to make ends meet. When we have a system where children are fed in schools and other basic responsibilities are also lifted from the shoulders of their parents, why should we be surprised that the sense of parental responsibility seems to be eroding? We are not surprised when a couch potato doesn't have the kind of muscles found on someone who exercises. Our society is increasingly turning out moral couch potatoes. Is the family becoming extinct? To the intelligentsia, the family, or the traditional family, as they say nowadays, is just one lifestyle among many. Moreover, they periodically announce its decline, with no sign whatever of regret, sometimes with just a touch of smugness. The latest census data show that the traditional family, a married couple and their children, constitute just a little less than one-fourth of all households. On the other hand, such families constituted just a little more than one-fourth of all families a decade ago. Any reports of the demise of the traditional family are greatly exaggerated. Snapshot statistics can be very misleading when you realize that people go through different stages of their lives. Even the most traditional families, including Ozzie and Harriet themselves, never permanently consisted of married couples and their children. Kids grow up and move out. People who get married do not start having children immediately. If every single person in the country got married and had children, married couple families with children would still not constitute 100% of households at any given time. With rising per capita incomes, more individuals can afford to have their own households. These include young unmarried adults, widows and widowers, and others who often lived with relatives in earlier times. When more such households are created, traditional family households automatically become a smaller percentage of all households. Incidentally, the growth of households containing one person, about 25% of all households today, is the reason why average household incomes are rising very little, even though per capita incomes have been rising very substantially. Gloom and doomers love to cite household income statistics in order to claim that Americans' incomes are stagnating, when in fact there has been an unprecedented and sustained rise in prosperity among women and men, blacks and whites, and virtually everybody else. Marriage does occur later today than in the past, and more people don't get married at all. But 53% of all households still contain married couples, with or without children currently living with them, while some of the other households contain widows and widowers whose marriages were ended only by death. Despite attempts to equate married couples with people who are living together as domestic partners, married couples are in fact better off than unmarried couples by almost any standard you can think of. Married couples have higher incomes, longer lives, better health, less violence, less alcohol, and less poverty. As Casey Stengel used to say, you can look it up. One place to look it up is in the book The Case for Marriage by Linda Waite and Maggie Gallagher. But this is just one place among many. You don't usually hear these kinds of facts because they are not considered to be politically correct when the media, politicians, academia, and the courts are busy trying to make all kinds of living arrangements seem equal. The latest census report on America's families and living arrangements contains all sorts of statistics, but avoids showing the most basic statistics on the average income of married couple families compared with other family households or with non-family households. The Census Bureau apparently does not want to be politically incorrect. If you dig through the census numbers, however, you will discover some revealing clues. While both unmarried partners and married spouses are spread up and down the income scale, the bracket with the largest number of men who are unmarried partners is the bracket between $30,000 and $40,000. The bracket with the largest number of husbands is between $50,000 and $75,000. Among married couple households, the bracket with the largest number of households is $75,000 and over. Among other family groups, the bracket with the largest number of households is that under $10,000. Women who are shacking up are four times as likely as wives to become victims of violence, and their children are 40 times as likely to be abused by live-in boyfriends as by their own parents. Despite all this, it remains dogma among those who set the ideological fashions that marriage is just another lifestyle, no better or worse than any other. Even the Census Bureau seems unwilling to publish statistical data that would go against this vision and rile up the anointed. Life at the bottom. Poverty used to mean hunger and inadequate clothing to protect you against the elements, as well as long hours of grinding labor to try to make ends meet. But today, most of the people living below the official poverty line not only have enough food, they are actually slightly more likely than others to be overweight. Ordinary clothing is so plentiful that young hoodlums fight over designer clothes or fancy sneakers. As for work, there is less of that in lower-income households today than among the affluent. Most of today's poor have color TV and microwave ovens. Poverty in the old physical sense is nowhere near as widespread as it once was. Yet life at the bottom is no picnic, and is too often a nightmare. A recently published book titled Life at the Bottom paints a brilliantly insightful but very painful picture of the underclass, its emptiness, agonies, violence, and moral squalor. This book is about a British underclass neighborhood where its author, Theodore Dalrymple, works as a doctor. That may, in fact, make its message easier for many Americans to understand and accept. Most of the people that Dalrymple writes about are white, so it may be possible at last to take an honest look at the causes and consequences of an underclass lifestyle without fear of being called racist. The people who are doing the same socially destructive and self-destructive things that are being done in underclass neighborhoods in the United States cannot claim that it is because their ancestors were enslaved or because they face racial discrimination. Once those cop-outs are out of the way, maybe we can face reality and even talk sense about how things became such a mess and such a horror. As an emergency room physician, Theodore Dalrymple treats youngsters who have been beaten up so badly that they require medical attention because they try to do well in school. When that happens in American ghettos, the victims have been accused of acting white by trying to get an education. On the other side of the Atlantic, both the victims and the hoodlums are white. The British underclass neighborhood in which Dalrymple works, like its American counterpart, features what he calls the kind of ferocious young egotist to whom I would give a wide berth in the broadest daylight. He sees also the destruction of the strong family ties that alone made emergence from poverty possible for large numbers of people. Dalrymple's own father was born in a slum, but in a very different social setting from that of today's underclass. For one thing, his father received a real education. The textbooks from which he was taught would be considered too tough in today's era of dumbed-down education. Dalrymple's father was given the tools to rise out of poverty, while today's underclass is not only denied those tools, but receives excuses for remaining in poverty, and ideologies blaming their plight on others, whom they are encouraged to envy and resent. The net result is an underclass generation that has trouble spelling simple words or doing elementary arithmetic, and which has no intention of developing job skills. By having their physical needs taken care of by the welfare state, as if they were livestock, the underclass are left with a life emptied of meaning, as Dalrymple says, since they cannot even take pride in providing their own food and shelter, as generations before them did. Worse, they are left with no sense of responsibility in a non-judgmental world. Some educators, intellectuals, and others may imagine that they are being friends of the poor by excusing or understanding their self-destructive behavior and encouraging a paranoid view of the larger world around them. But the most important thing anyone can do for the poor is to help them get out of poverty, as Dalrymple's father was helped by those who taught him and held him to standards, treating him as a responsible human being, not livestock. No summary can do justice to the vivid examples and penetrating insights in Life at the Bottom. It needs to be read with the understanding that its story is also our story. Twisted History. One of the reasons our children do not measure up academically to children in other countries is that so much time is spent in American classrooms twisting our history for ideological purposes. How would you feel if you were a Native American who saw the European invaders taking away your land? Is the kind of question our children are likely to be confronted with in our schools. It is a classic example of trying to look at the past with the assumptions and the ignorance of the present. One of the things we take for granted today is that it is wrong to take other people's land by force. Neither American Indians nor the European invaders believed that. Both took other people's land by force, as did Asians, Africans, Arabs, Polynesians, and others. The Indians no doubt regretted losing so many battles, but that is wholly different from saying that they thought battles were the wrong way to settle the question of who would control the land. Today's child cannot possibly put himself or herself in the mindset of Indians centuries ago without infinitely more knowledge of history than our schools have ever taught. Nor is understanding history the purpose of such questions. The purpose is to score points against Western society. In short, propaganda has replaced education as the goal of too many educators. Schools are not the only institutions that twist history to score ideological points. "Never forget that they owned lots of slaves," was the huge headline across the front page of the New York Times book review section in its December 14, 2004 issue. Inside was an indictment of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Of all the tragic facts about the history of slavery, the most astonishing to an American today is that, although slavery was a worldwide institution for thousands of years, nowhere in the world was slavery a controversial issue prior to the 18th century. People of every race and color were enslaved, and enslaved others. White people were still being bought and sold as slaves in the Ottoman Empire, decades after American blacks were freed. Everyone hated the idea of being a slave, but few had any qualms about enslaving others. Slavery was just not an issue, not even among intellectuals, much less among political leaders, until the 18th century, and then it was an issue only in Western civilization. Among those who turned against slavery in the 18th century were George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and other American leaders. You could research all of 18th century Africa or Asia or the Middle East without finding any comparable rejection of slavery there. But who is singled out for scathing criticism today? American leaders of the 18th century. Deciding that slavery was wrong was much easier than deciding what to do with millions of people from another continent, of another race, and without any historical preparation for living as free citizens in a society like that of the United States, where they were 20% of the total population. It is clear from the private correspondence of Washington, Jefferson, and many others that their moral rejection of slavery was unambiguous, but the practical question of what to do now had them baffled. that would remain so for more than half a century. In 1862, a ship carrying slaves from Africa to Cuba, in violation of a ban on the international slave trade, was captured on the high seas by the U.S. Navy. The crew were imprisoned, and the captain was hanged in the United States, despite the fact that slavery itself was still legal at the time in Africa, in Cuba, and in the United States. What does this tell us? That enslaving people was considered an abomination. But what to do with millions of people who were already enslaved was not equally clear. That question was finally answered by a war in which one life was lost for every six people freed. Maybe that was the only answer. But don't pretend today that it was an easy answer, or that those who grappled with the dilemma in the 18th century were some special villains, when most leaders and most people around the world at that time saw nothing wrong with slavery. Incidentally, the September 2004 issue of National Geographic had an article about the millions of people still enslaved around the world right now. But where was the moral indignation about that? Animal rights. If you think there is a limit to how much childishness there is among Californians, you may want to reconsider, especially for Californians in academic communities. Recently, a mountain lion was discovered up in a tree in Palo Alto, a residential community adjacent to Stanford University. This was at about the time of day when a nearby school was getting ready to let out. There had already been an incident of a horse being found mauled by some animal on Stanford land, and some thought it might have been a mountain lion that did it. Fearing that the mountain lion might find one of the local school children a tempting target, the police shot and killed the animal. Outrage against the police erupted up and down the San Francisco Peninsula and as far away as Marin County, on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge, more than 30 miles away. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the police agency has been flooded with outraged calls and emails from people inflamed by TV news videotape of the lion lolling peacefully in a tree just before an officer shot it to death with a high-powered rifle. Yes, the mountain lion was sitting peacefully. That is what cats do before they pounce, usually very swiftly. Second-guessers always have easy alternatives. One protester against the murdering of such a beautiful creature said that it easily could have been removed from the premises and relocated, and that the dirty, bloodthirsty bastards who killed it should be ashamed of themselves. The protester offered no helpful hints on how you easily remove a mountain lion from a tree, and certainly did not volunteer to demonstrate how to do it in person the next time the police find a mountain lion up a tree in a residential neighborhood. Animal rights advocates said the police could have given the mountain lion a chance by attempting to tranquilize it while it was up in the tree, and save shooting as a last resort if it turned aggressive. A makeshift shrine has been erected on the spot where the mountain lion died. Flowers, cards, and photos have been placed around it. This is an academic community where indignation is a way of life. Those engaged in moral exhibitionism have no time for mundane realities. The police, of course, have to deal with mundane realities all the time. Not long before this episode, the police had tried to capture three mountain lion cubs by shooting them with tranquilizers. They missed on two out of three tries with one cub. What if the police had shot a tranquilizer gun at the adult mountain lion in the tree and missed? Would they have had a chance to get off a second shot at a swiftly moving target before he pounced on one of the hundreds of children that were soon to be leaving school near him? Moral exhibitionists never make allowance for the police missing, whether with tranquilizers shot at mountain lions or bullets fired at a criminal. The perpetually indignant are forever wondering why it took so many shots. It would never occur to people with academic degrees and professorships that they are both ignorant and incompetent in vast areas of human life, much less that they should keep that in mind before they vent their emotions and wax self-righteous. Degrees show that you have knowledge in some special area. Too often, they embolden people to pontificate on a wide range of other subjects where they don't know what they are talking about. The fact that academics are overwhelmingly of the political left is perfectly consistent with their assumption that third parties, especially third parties like themselves, should be controlling the decisions of other people who have first-hand knowledge and experience. The cops probably haven't read Chaucer and don't know what existentialism is, but they may know what danger is. Some Palo Alto parents of small children living near where the mountain lion was killed said that the police did the right thing. There are still some pockets of sanity, even in Palo Alto. Human livestock. An old television special featured great boxing matches of the past, including a video of a match between legendary light heavyweight champion Archie Moore and a young Canadian fighter named Yvon Durrell. In that fight, each man was knocked down 4 times. Since Archie Moore was also among those serving as commentators on the program, someone asked him if he knew that this was a great boxing match while he was fighting it. "Yes," he replied emphatically. At the time, he had said to himself, "This is the kind of fight that any fighter would love to be in, a knockdown, drag-out, and emerge the winner." Overcoming adversity is one of our great desires and one of our great sources of pride, but it is something that our anointed deep thinkers strive to eliminate from our lives through everything from grade inflation to the welfare state. The anointed want to eliminate stress, challenge, striving, and competition. They want the necessities of life to be supplied as rights, which is to say at the taxpayer's expense, without anyone's being forced to work for those necessities, except, of course, the taxpayers. Nothing is to be earned. Self-esteem is to be dispensed to school children as largesse from the teacher. Adults are to have their medical care and other necessities dispensed as largesse from the government. People are to be mixed and matched by race and sex and whatever else the anointed want to take into account in order to present whatever kind of picture the anointed think should be presented. This is a vision of human beings as livestock to be fed by the government and herded and tended by the anointed. All the things that make us human beings are to be removed from our lives, and we are to live as denatured creatures controlled and directed by our betters. Those things that help human beings be independent and self-reliant, whether automobiles, guns, the free market, or vouchers, provoke instant hostility from the anointed. Automobiles enable you to come and go as you wish, without so much as a buy your leave to your betters. The very idea that other people will go where they want, live where they want, how they want, and send their children to whatever schools they choose is galling to the anointed, for it denies the very specialness that is at the heart of their picture of themselves. Guns are completely inappropriate for the kind of sheep-like people the anointed envision, or the orderly, prepackaged world in which they are to live. When you are in mortal danger, you are supposed to dial 911, so that the police can arrive on the scene sometime later, identify your body, and file reports in triplicate. The free market is a daily assault on the vision of the anointed. Just think of all those millions of people out there buying whatever they want, whenever they want, whether or not the anointed think it is good for them. Think of those people earning whatever incomes they happen to get from producing goods or services for other people at prices resulting from supply and demand, with the anointed cut out of the loop entirely and standing on the sidelines in helpless frustration, unable to impose their particular vision of social justice. The welfare state is not really about the welfare of the masses. It is about the egos of the elites. One of the most dangerous things about the welfare state is that it breaks the connection between what people have produced and what they consume, at least in many people's minds. For the society as a whole, that connection remains as fixed as ever, but the welfare state makes it possible for individuals to think of money or goods as just arbitrary dispensations. Thus, those who have less can feel a grievance against society and are less inhibited about stealing or vandalizing. And the very concept of gratitude or obligation disappears, even the obligation of common decency out of respect for other people. The next time you see a bum leaving drug needles in a park where children play or urinating in the street, you are seeing your tax dollars at work and the end result of the vision of the anointed.
The Einstein Syndrome. What have famed pianist Arthur Rubinstein, Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, India's self-taught mathematical genius Ramanujan, Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker, talk show host G. Gordon Liddy, and renowned physicists Richard Feynman, Edward Teller, and Albert Einstein all had in common? Aside from being remarkable people, they were all late in beginning to speak when they were children. Edward Teller, for example, did not say anything that anyone understood until he was 4 years old. Einstein began talking at age 3, but he was still not fluent when he turned 9. While most children who are late in beginning to speak are male, there have also been some female late talkers. Celebrated 19th-century pianist Clara Schumann and outstanding 20th-century mathematician Julia Robinson, the first woman to become president of the American Mathematical Association. In addition, there have been innumerable people of exceptional ability in a number of fields who were years behind the norm for developing the ability to speak when they were children. Parents and professionals alike have been baffled as to the reason for delayed speech in children whose precocious intellectual development was obvious even when they were toddlers. Some of these kids can put together puzzles designed for older children or for adults. Some can use computers by themselves as early as age 2, even though they remain silent while their peers are developing the ability to speak. No one really knows for sure why this is so. These children have only begun to be studied within the past decade. My own book, The Einstein Syndrome, is one such study. More research on these children is being conducted by Professor Stephen Camerata at the Vanderbilt University Medical School. He was himself late in talking. Research on Einstein's brain has suggested to some neuroscientists that he was late in talking because of the unusual development of his brain, as revealed by an autopsy. Those portions of his brain where analytical thinking was concentrated had spread out far beyond their usual area and spilled over into adjoining areas, including the region from which speech is usually controlled. This has led some neuroscientists to suggest that his genius and his late talking could have been related. At this point, no one knows whether this is the reason why Einstein took so long to develop the ability to speak, much less whether this is true of the other people of outstanding intellect who were also late in beginning to speak. What is known, however, is that there are a number of disabilities that are more common among people of high intellect than in the general population. Members of the High IQ Mensa Society, for example, have a far higher than normal incidence of allergies. A sample of youngsters enrolled in the Johns Hopkins program for mathematically precocious youths, kids who can score 700 on the math SAT when they are just 12 years old, showed that more than four-fifths of them were allergic and/or myopic and/or left-handed. This is all consistent with one region of the brain having above normal development and taking resources that leave some other region or regions with less than the usual resources for performing other functions. It is also consistent with the fact that some bright children who talk late remain impervious to all attempts of parents or professionals to get them to talk at the normal time. Yet these same kids later begin to speak on their own, sometimes after parents have finally just given up hope and stopped trying. Noted language authority and neuroscientist Steven Pinker of MIT says, "Language seems to develop about as quickly as the growing brain can handle it." While this was a statement about the general development of language, it may be especially relevant to bright children who talk late. As the whole brain grows in early childhood, increasing the total resources available, the regions whose resources have been preempted elsewhere can now catch up and develop normally. My research and that of Professor Camerata have turned up a number of patterns in children with the Einstein syndrome that were similar to what biographies of Einstein himself reveal. Most children who talk late are not like those in our studies, but a remarkable number are. Unfortunately, many of these children get misdiagnosed as retarded, autistic,
or as having an attention deficit disorder. The right stuff. One of the greatest inventions of the 20th century, indeed one of the landmark inventions in the history of the human race, was the work of a couple of young men who had never gone to college and who were just bicycle mechanics in Dayton, Ohio. That part of the United States is often referred to disdainfully as flyover country, because it is part of America that the East Coast and West Coast elites fly over on their way to what they consider more important places. But they are able to fly over it only because of those mechanics in Dayton. The Wright brothers' first airplane flight was only about 120 feet, roughly the distance from home plate to second base, and not as long as the wingspan of a 747. But it began one of the longest journeys ever taken by the human race, and that journey is not over yet as we soar farther into space. Man had dreamed of flying for centuries, and others were hard at work on the project in various places around the world when the Wright brothers finally got their plane off the ground on December 17, 1903. It didn't matter how long or how short the flight was. What mattered was that they showed that it could be done. Alas, Orville and Wilbur Wright are today pigeonholed as dead white males, whom we are supposed to ignore, if not deplore. Had either of them been a woman, or black, or any of a number of other specially singled out groups, the 100th anniversary of their flight would have been a national holiday, with an orgy of parades and speeches across the length and breadth of the country. Recently, a reporter for a well-known magazine phoned me to check on some facts about famous people who talked late and whom I had mentioned in my book, The Einstein Syndrome. Her editor wanted to know why there was not more diversity among the people I cited. Almost all of them were men, for example, and white men at that. The vast majority of people who talk late are boys, and I had no control over that. In a predominantly white society, it should not be surprising that famous men who talked late were mostly white. No doubt in China, most would be Chinese. The reporter seemed somewhat relieved when I pointed out that the distinguished mathematician Julia Robinson and famed 19th century concert pianist Clara Schumann were among the women discussed in my book. Ramanujan, a self-taught mathematical genius from India, came to my attention right after the book went into print, but the reporter seemed happy to be able to add his name to the list of famous late talkers. This mania for diversity has spread far and wide. When I looked through my niece's high school math book, I saw many pictures of noted mathematicians, but, judging by those pictures, you would never dream that anything worth noting had ever been done in mathematics by any white males. This petty-minded falsification of history is less disturbing than the indoctrination-minded educators who are twisting reality to fit their vision. Those who cannot tell the difference between education and brainwashing do not belong in our schools. History is what happened, not what we wish had happened or what a theory says should have happened. One of the reasons for the great value of history is that it allows us to check our current beliefs against hard facts from around the world and across the centuries. But history cannot be a reality check for today's fashionable visions when history is itself shaped by those visions. When that happens, we are sealing ourselves up in a closed world of assumptions. There is no evidence that the Wright brothers intended the airplane to be flown or ridden in only by white people. Many of the great breakthroughs in science and technology were gifts to the whole human race. Those whose efforts created these breakthroughs were exalted because of their contributions to mankind, not to their particular tribe or sex. In trying to cheapen those people as dead white males, we only cheapen ourselves, and do nothing to promote similar achievements by people of every description. When the Wright brothers rose off the ground, we all rose off the ground. Revisionists Against America. An American of Chinese ancestry got into big trouble when the private school at which he was teaching had a public discussion of the American bombing of Hiroshima. He recalled how, as someone growing up in China, he had rejoiced when he heard of the bombing, knowing that it could deliver his people from the horrors inflicted on them by the Japanese. That, of course, was not the politically correct response, as he soon discovered from the backlash, hostility, and ostracism that eventually culminated in his leaving the school. The anointed do not want anyone upsetting their vision. When they say diversity, this is not what they have in mind. Hiroshima has become one of the many symbols of a countercultural hostility to America among the intelligentsia in general and the revisionist historians in particular. The 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, galvanized Newsweek magazine into Monday morning quarterbacking half a century after that Sunday. The revisionist line is that it was unnecessary to bomb Hiroshima. We could have invaded. We could have negotiated a settlement. We could have done all sorts of things. Newsweek magazine's estimate today is that there might have been 20,000 Americans killed in an invasion of Japan. This is quite a contrast with the estimates of the people who had the heavy responsibility of fighting the war at the time. General Douglas MacArthur, who had been selected to command the invasion of Japan before the atomic bomb was tested and shown to work, told Secretary of War Stimson to expect more than 1 million American casualties alone. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill also expected more than 1 million American casualties, together with 500,000 casualties among the British troops who were scheduled to hit the beaches with the Americans. Anyone familiar with the history of the Japanese soldiers' bitter resistance to the death, very few were captured alive, will have no trouble understanding why such huge casualties were expected. American Marines lost more than 5,000 men taking the little island of Iwo Jima, and the Japanese themselves suffered more than 100,000 deaths when Americans captured Japan's outlying island of Okinawa. That was more than were killed at Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Newsweek's pushover scenario, which would have had Japan defeated in 90 days, would be funny if it were not so sick. Winston Churchill's estimate to the House of Commons would have had the war with Japan ending in 1946, and the Pentagon's estimate was that Japan might even hold out until 1947. Not only was there a Japanese army which had proven its toughness and skill on many a battlefield, there were 5,000 kamikaze planes ready for suicide attacks on Americans invading their homeland. If these planes managed to take out just 5 Americans each, they alone would have killed more troops than those in Newsweek's rosy scenario. Japan's civilian population, including children, were also being mobilized and trained in suicide attacks on enemy troops and tanks. It would have been one of the great bloodbaths of all time. Of course, Japan could have been defeated without the atomic bomb. But at what cost in lives of people killed in other ways, and in larger numbers? The other tack taken by the revisionist historians is to say that Japan was ready to surrender before the atomic bombs were dropped. The most obvious question is, why didn't they do it then? Indeed, why didn't they do it after Hiroshima was bombed, and thereby spare Nagasaki? Whatever negotiations may have been going on behind the scenes, surrender was by no means a done deal. Even after both cities had been destroyed, it took the unprecedented intervention of the emperor himself to get the military men to agree to surrender. And even as the emperor's message was being broadcast, some military officers were killed trying to storm the studio where the broadcast originated. The real question is not whether Japan was willing to negotiate some